understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Over the course of a thoroughly entertaining hour last Saturday, Joseph O'Connor reminisced about one of the great highlights of his life, following the Irish football fans on their adventures around America for his 1994 Sunday Tribune World Cup diary. One of those adventures featured a young man who got a little carried away by the excitement of the historic victory over Italy, leading a mini pitch invasion, which did not go down well with the New Jersey police officers present. This young man was handcuffed and led off the pitch, creating quite the controversy.
Took a few thumps as well, Owen.
Listen, there's a bit of stuff going on. After some further digging on our parts and some incredible photographic evidence, we managed to establish the troublemaker in question has gone on to become one of Ireland's most successful actors, appearing in bloody Conclave, one of the world's biggest movies last year. Yes, the unruly pitch invader in question is Brian F. O'Byrne. Last week, we put the call out publicly for Brian to appear on the show to relive this dramatic episode of his life. And I'm pleased to report that he has answered the call here. And he will join us in studio on Second Captain Saturday today. Oh, my David here with Kieran Murphy. This incident, Murph, that we're talking about, it was big news back home in the days that followed that Italy game.
Owen, you're not joking. So Brian was one of three pitch invaders after perhaps like the greatest victory in the history of Irish
sport.
That's
up there for sure.
And like, we couldn't believe this, right? But the first edition of The Examiner that came out after Ireland had beaten Italy 1-0 in the bloody World Cup had a photo not of Ray Houghton or Paul McGrath or Jack Charlton, but of police arresting a giant stadium pitch invader, and the front page headline, Furore Over Fans Arrest. The FAI security officer at the time, Joe Delaney, is quoted saying that the fans were a disgrace to everyone else and had tarnished the reputation of Irish fans. The Monday morning headline in the Irish Independent was, Invading Fans Told You'll Be Deported.
Wow.
This is
heavy stuff.
And there's a huge photo of a handcuffed Brian with his back turned and a concerned looking Jack Charlton with his hand around his neck. So yeah, very little sympathy in Ireland for Brian and the fans, aside from Big Jack, of course. And you mentioned some of the photos. Oh my God, the photos are incredible and hilarious. We've dug out some dramatic pics of a young, green-haired Brian O'Byrne that we've helpfully posted on Instagram for you all to see right now.
Listen, thankfully, all I can say is Brian's acting career survived that early scandal. He's won a Tony Award for his theatre work in the US, is a BAFTA Award winner, has been nominated for an Emmy. As I mentioned, he stars in the Oscar-winning Conclave and even appears in Million Dollar Baby, which is one of the most famous sports movies of all time. That may just earn him the extra points he needs to pip Joseph O'Connor to top spot in our greatest non-sportsperson competition for 2025.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Owen, if Joseph O'Connor is to be pipped, as you suggest, then Brian will have to get to 79 points or better after I've looked him in the eye and assessed his athletic bona fides. The scoring thus far this series has been sedate. Can Brian break the logjam and cannonball his way into the stagnant waters of our quest to find our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson of 2025? It's been up and down for the thespians on this show over the years, it must be said. Fiona Shaw was a tennis brat and got 85 points for her efforts. Gabriel Byrne was a 24-time winner of the Walkinstown Street Football FA Cup Final and only ended up with 75 points. I gotta tell you, Owen, I've got high hopes for Brian, but only time and my capricious scoring system will tell.
Email us, editor at secondcaptains.com. Message us on Instagram at secondcaptains. Thanks for all of your kind messages after last week's show, Joseph O'Connor. But we have a new challenger in studio right now, Brian F. O'Byrne. We need you to, first of all, just confirm you are indeed that pitch-invading Ireland fan from Joseph O'Connor's World Cup diary.
I am the person.
Okay. Needed to get that sorted straight off the bat. You were living and working in New York at the time. Where was your career at?
I was. So I was living in New York. I spent about 20 years total in New York. And at that particular time, I was doing a show on Broadway for a year-long thing. And it was my first show I'd done on Broadway. I was playing a play by a lady called Wendy Wasserstein, ironically wearing a England jersey, national jersey.
All right.
I wanted to wear a Liverpool one, but the designer wouldn't let me in, and we were taking over cast. So she allowed me to wear this English jersey, and the World Cup was coming to the US, and I had been a huge international, Irish international soccer fan. I used to go all the time to Lansdowne Road. So, and of course, we could, at that time, there wasn't the internet and you couldn't really get a lot of soccer and in the United States from at home. So when I was coming over, I was so excited that finally this great sport was going to arrive with a bang.
Oh, I can only imagine.
New York, yeah.
It must have been a huge point of pride for everyone at home and Cavan for your family and that you were over there at that age acting on Broadway, making a success of yourself.
Oh my God, it couldn't be further from the point. No. I don't think so.
No?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I have a strange relationship with being an actor and maybe, I don't know. I think it would have been a lot easier if I'd been successful in construction.
Right.
It would have been an easier conversation perhaps to have.
Yeah.
I think I have always been kind of taking a circuitous route to stuff. I never wanted to be an actor. I didn't grow up wanting to be an actor. My stock answer used to be that if you failed enough exams, you end up being an actor. that was my path. But I ended up just around the corner here, actually, in Trinity in the second year of its drama program, utterly by default. I wasn't going to be an actor after that. I knew I wasn't good enough to be an actor. And right after that, then I won a green card in the famous Donnelly visas, which I hadn't applied for. My uncle had put in my name.
Okay.
So that brought me over to America. And
so just on that, your uncle had put in your name for a visa for you to go and live and work in America without your knowledge.
Yeah, it wasn't completely irrational for him. If you can think back to, well, you're all too young, but the 80s in Ireland, it was really a rather grim place. And it was really, where were you going to go? Like, where were you going to emigrate to? So the Donnelly visas were the things that were popping and everybody was applying. Mm. Everyone just put, because all you had to do was put your name and date of birth. So there wasn't really, it was yeah, like an old-fashioned lotto in a way. And then you did the work afterwards if you wanted to go over there. Because of what had happened with the lobbying campaign of the Irish over in New York at the time, it kind of coincided with the change in immigration law in the United States that the Irish were, and we were at the forefront of changing the law, so we got special benefits. So if the 150,000 were given out each year, 50,000 were guaranteed to be Irish.
All right.
I had been there before I went to over here to college. I'd gone for a mad summer to New York City and stayed with my uncle and had a crazy time. So I guess he knew. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. Mm. So come to America. You know, there's a lot of Irish over there who don't know what they were doing at the time.
Yeah.
You mentioned that how excited you were that the World Cup was coming, that the Irish football team was coming. I presume tickets were gold dust for the Italy game. How'd you get your hands on a ticket for that?
Yeah, you know, I was in the play for a year. It's one of those odd things where you can take a vacation, you can take a 2 week holiday, you can plan it. And I had gotten tickets for the two other games, Mexico and Norway, Mexico down in Florida and then Norway in Jersey as well, in New Jersey. And but the Italian one was the one that nobody could get. And the company manager came in on a Friday night. I was taking my vacation on the Monday. Mondays are day off in theater. And on the Friday night, the company manager said, I've got tickets for the game. But they were like $350 each, which seemed extraordinarily expensive. And so I said, fine, listen, I'll take them. I was due to have two shows the following day. I had a small part in it. So I was like, this is a bit of a conundrum. She knew what she was doing, handing it over to me, the tickets. Mm. But I couldn't say that, okay, I may be sick tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I checked with my understudy. There's a room upstairs in Broadway Shows where there's a bunch of people, waiting for something horrible to happen to the people on stage. And the understudy said, yeah, he was ready. And that was it. I checked. I went out that night, which was the big mistake. And then in the morning, I called the understudy. Said, are you okay to go on? He said, yes. And then
off you went.
Yeah.
What was it about the night before that was the big mistake going out?
it was a horrible confluence of me starting to realize what a blackout was. So I was hugely excited, obviously. We had gotten the news that there was no alcohol, obviously, in Giant Stadium. So I thought, okay, well, I got to start drinking tonight. This is going to be a good party tonight. And I was going to go out, and rather than just make my way from Manhattan over to Jersey, I was doing, again, the circuitous route to go out to Sunnyside, Queens, to get in a bus with a bunch of other Irish people, and then come from Queens through Manhattan across to Jersey. So I stayed out very late. I made my way somehow over to Queens early in the morning, got on a bus there. Everyone decided to get six packs and everything. Got off the bus in Jersey, walked upstairs, and in the state that I was currently, I thought I was like, hey, this is, I'm too drunk actually. But you know when you're, well, you might know this, but if you're too drunk, you don't necessarily know how everybody else is around you, if they're as drunk as you at all. And I got into the stadium and I saw there was beer. I was like, wow, okay.
Oh, right. They were serving it in the
stadium. They were serving it. And that was like the bit.
All your prep work was
That was it.
Yes.
It was unnecessary, but I was obviously glad I had done it, and it made the sight of a bar even better. Mm. And unfortunately, more important almost than the game. So I went and got beer.
What do you remember of the game itself then and your own cameo in it, Breen?
Oh, gosh. I feel like I need a couch to lie down now.
Well, listen, we have one outside.
This could be a long... Is this going to be a four-parter?
Well, I thought it might be a very short answer. I thought it might be I don't remember anything.
Oh, no. I have vivid moments of the game, but they're not the vivid moments that anyone else would have.
Yeah.
So they're not the vivid moments of everyone else going, can you believe how many Irish were there?
Yeah.
Will you ever forget
the Ray Houghton
national
goal
anthem? Will you ever forget that? And my answer is yes. I have no idea that I experienced them. I think I entered, which was the first time in my life, a blackout that I was aware of.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So I should say that, back this up, maybe there's a thing. I've been sober for 24 years, so
yeah.
You know, this was the start of something that
yeah.
it was a moment, but it was not the moment that maybe the picture of me with green hair with Jack Charlton standing beside me is actually what the story is about for me.
Yeah.
So what do I remember? I remember at one stage turning to a row of Italian people behind me who didn't look happy. I mean, it's literally an image. I remember cheering for the goal. I remember making my way down the steps to leap onto the pitch at the end. I was there the following week, by the way,
yeah.
And I couldn't believe the drop. Like, it was about a, 15 or 20 foot drop down. But I then remember I remember the feeling of like landing, trying to get up, and then being pummeled by these guys, right? And I remember the smell of grass, you know? And then I remember just getting up and like kind of inhaling and opening my eyes, and Jack Charlton is standing in front of me and his hair is waving a little bit. And he's saying something to the people on my left or right. I don't know what's going on. And I roar at him like, we won. And then I don't remember him leaving or anything. But then I remember this moment walking up the ramp, because the little prison area in behind was underneath the stadium, and we're walking up kind of this ramp with various people walking along. I was walking along handcuffed, being led or pushed by a couple of cops.
I know it's about a lot more than just the photo of you and Jack Chapman, but it is an unbelievable image I have in front of me here.
Oh, yeah.
You've got your green hair, as
green
you mentioned
hair,
there.
Yeah.
You're cuffed. You've just been knocked around the place a little bit, as you said.
Mm.
Jack is interceding on your behalf.
Which is extraordinary.
Which is extraordinary that he...
Yeah.
That is something that...
extraordinary and in some ways not surprising, I think.
Yeah,
he presumably just wanted to make sure you were going to be okay. He sees his Ireland fan here.
Yeah, well, no, listen, in the cops' defense, America was waiting for the World Cup to come at the first time. What do Americans know about sports, soccer fans?
They would think
hooligans.
Especially then,
at that time.
They're still thinking late 80s stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're waiting for absolute thugs. Now, really, if I'd met a cop and he put his arms out for a hug, I'd be hugging him still. You know what I mean? It wasn't that type of thing. But they were worried that, you know, and I was a GA head. Like, what do GA people do? Like, open the case, we'll walk on the pitch afterwards, you know? And I'm not, that's not a defence.
It's just the shortest way to the car, that's all.
That's it. So, but it did speak volumes about Jack. I thought, wow, at that moment, he decided to walk out of his way to stop something. Like, and he was in my defence, which is really, doesn't it speak volumes about him?
Yeah, absolutely. You were taken to the cells, to a cell underneath, at the stadium, is that right?
Yeah, they had a court set up there and everything, was cops in there. And so they kept me in there. And because of the state that I was in, I was then entered into, what's that? What's the movie with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman? Begins with a P, in a prison in Turkey.
Oh, Papillon.
Papillon. I was basically living Papillon in the first couple of minutes. Or I don't know how long I was in there, a couple of hours.
Yeah, yeah.
As they tried to essentially get me to pay money for a fine. Mm-hmm. I didn't have enough cash on me to pay the fine for some reason. I didn't have enough cash, probably because I spent it on the alcohol upstairs. But and they couldn't. I don't know what. I can't really. I know I was getting belligerent. They were really pissed off at me. I could, because of my job as an actor and being familiar with movies and plays about court cases and travesties of injustice, I was aware of this good cop, bad cop thing happening in front of me as well, which I was able to tell them, talk to them about as well, which I'm sure they were very receptive to. Then they tried
just shouting Latin phrases, you know.
And anyway, after some, they just took whatever money I had on me and said, that's a no, look, they just wanted to get me out. They then tried to throw me out, and I made the rather unusual decision then to put my feet up on the jars of the door, not to be let out, so I could file a complaint.
Oh God!
And then they threw me out. They've threw me out. I have an image, all right, of people working obviously there who just kind of lifted their heads and stopped their work to see green-haired, pasty guy just nonsense. I was thrown out. The car park that was completely full was so empty. And my uncle was standing there in front. I went with my uncle and he leapt on behind me. So it was a family thing that had happened. He had jumped on behind as well. And we went and got on a bus. There was one bus at the end of the car. And I knew I had no money to get it back. So we got on a bus and...
Hadn't you been charged with what Joseph O'Connor wrote up as tumultuous behaviour for no apparent reason.
You know what? I got to look it up because I did keep the charge.
The charge sheet?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the charge sheet. I have it somewhere. I don't know. I've moved too many times since, but I had that. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, for no apparent reason, which was obviously I had a strong defence.
Ireland won. Italy nil was the reason, surely. Yeah.
How did the night end up from there?
Well, it went terrible. I mean,
couldn't have got much worse, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, there was I can't believe I'm going to reveal this, but we got dropped off outside of, there was an incredible, a really wonderful bar in New York called Paddy Riley's. It still exists. And there was a cabman used to run it called Steve. And it was an amazing place for trad music. We used to go on a Monday night to listen to trad music there all the time. And dropped off there and I walked in, wounded, heroic, obviously. Walked in and walked up to the bar, pushed my way up to the bar, squeezed in, ordered more alcohol. And I turned to I'm waiting to kind of tell my story to somebody. And I turned to my left and sitting at the bar was Paul Hill from
The Guildford Four.
Oh, right. And so obviously we had a lot in common. after what I had gone through.
Wrongful imprisonment.
Yes, wrongful imprisonment, where I did just say, tried to start off a conversation. Paul Hill, I was like, wow, you wouldn't believe where I am, and let's talk. We didn't, thankfully.
How did everyone at home find out about this? Was it on the news?
It was on the papers at home, fortunately. And it totally broke me, because all of a sudden it was, I was banned for life from Lansdowne Road.
Right.
Automatically. I was banned for life. Although, sorry, and that was rescinded after I won a Tony Award. Did I win it? No, anyway, the play won. We won Tony's from Army Dunstan. And it was rescinded.
Okay.
That was rescinded. And it was through the radio as well. I was doing a radio and they got a call in saying that had been rescinded.
From the FAI?
Yes, there was a call in from the FAI. So just in case anybody has problems with the FAI or a bar.
Just go win
anything.
A Tony.
Exactly.
Any of the EGOTs, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony, any of those. Yeah.
So, but it was actually in a serious thing. It was because I was very conscious of trying to promote Irish culture and all that sort of thing, you know. And at the time in the East Village in New York, there was a lot of young Irish over there kind of just trying to look at what it meant to be Irish and all that sort of stuff, as people do when they leave anyway. But this was kind of a group who were staying outside of the quote-unquote ghetto areas and all that, and a bunch of artists who were trying to find an expression on what this what it means to be Irish now. And you know, Jack's Team, in a sense, was the first opening up of what does it mean to be Irish, and, you know, with our first and second generation, or Tony Cascarino, whatever.
Whatever generation that was. Yeah.
That we can be, what does that mean? And what sort of Ireland are we? And, you know, I liked soccer at that time because we didn't really have a chance to fly tricolours often. You know, in the 80s in Ireland, it was, you only really waved a tricolour if it had got to do with Northern Ireland, a certain type of politics. I was invested in what it meant to be that, and I felt like I had achieved something to get to Broadway.
Yeah, you had,
but then it was just like a joke. It was like, look at this fucking idiot. Mm. Which is true, he was an idiot. I mean, I know the inside story now because of, you know, with alcohol and stuff like that, but it was just like, god damn it, that's it? Like, that's what that becomes?
Can you remember what your parents thought?
Yeah, it was... my dad basically just said this one line on the phone. He wouldn't be a person. I don't think I've ever received a phone call, maybe one from him. He just went, my ma said, your dad wants to say something to you. Like, okay. And he just went, they say you've let Ireland down.
Wow.
And I was like,
that's pretty devastating.
Okay. Mm. Right, I've let Ireland down. And it was on the front pages and stuff. It was on the news and kind of like going, what are we going to do about this? You know, is this going to be a problem? And I just wanted to kind of go, no, time out. This is kind of silly. And here I am trying to look at, and you know, ironically, propagating a drunk Irish image.
Yeah, how do you mean?
Well, in that, that's what I was. I was a drunk Irish person with green hair falling around the field in New Jersey. I mean, that's like if somebody is involved in the arts, like going, well, you know, sitting down and having deep thoughts with a bunch of other Irish people in the East Village at the time. There was Sinné and, all that stuff was happening and bubbling under in the East Village. And Irish people were like making these moves into various fields that one wouldn't necessarily anticipate Irish people in. Because before that we were, you know, construction and nurses and all this. And I mean, there was always writers and stuff like that. But there was certainly an energy around the East Village in New York at the time that was... it felt special. It was probably just me being young, but it felt special, and that's what I could present.
Yeah. Obviously, it's at one level, it's a funny story of a crazy thing you did in your 20s on the day of Ireland's greatest football moment.
You know? Yeah.
But it does sound like it actually had a major impact on your life as well.
Yeah, it did. It did. It did, actually. Yeah, it did, because...
Did it help you understand that you had an issue with alcohol?
Oh, my God, I wish it did. No.
Right.
But it was the turning point. I didn't realize it then. Listen, if anybody has problems with addiction or anything like this, you don't know. It depends how far down the elevator lift, as people say, in any type of addiction go, that you're going to keep going lower and lower and lower. You ask about, like, the game. What really happened was, and it was a number of weeks later, there was a very famous barman over in America, John, and I went to him and he had a picture of the game. He was at the game and he showed a picture of the game, and I couldn't believe it, because Italy were in white. Yeah. And I had no idea.
He thought they were wearing their normal blue.
Of course. I had no idea. And I went, what? Okay. And you just, if you don't know, I didn't know what blackouts were or anything like that. I was like, oh, okay. Well, and you'd be embarrassed to go, oh, yeah. I went to the game. Oh, yeah?
Did you say it to him at the time, or did you actually see it and you were so shocked that you actually said, I'm not going to even reveal this?
No, I did say it to John. Yeah, I said it to John. I did say it. Yeah. I don't think I ever said it. Again, because, I forget that they were in white.
Yeah.
Because
I
didn't witness it. And I went, no. So it took maybe about 10 years after, 10 years of different variants of green-haired, pasty white guy falling down.
Different versions, less spectacular versions, or less public versions of that
less
same
public.
Story.
Less public. But causing more damage.
It must have, hearing your father say those words to you over the phone, must have cut you to your core.
Yeah, it did. But, like...
It was also little over the top as well.
It's a dramatic statement. But in their defense... it was all over the news, and it's on the front page, and like going, it's got to be incredibly embarrassing. And those, that phrase was used. They had let Ireland, these people have let Ireland down. I'm sure the FAI, I think, said that. These people have let Ireland down. Mm. And you kind of go, wait, I didn't know I was carrying Ireland on that day. I thought the 11 out on the pitch were carrying Ireland. I didn't realise that I was like the 12th sub, come on and let Ireland down. Won. And, oh, yeah, I think I was the first Irish supporter arrested in, I don't know, was it 20 years or something like that? And you kind of go, oh, okay.
Have you ever actually spoken about what happened back then and the aftermath of it in the way you're talking about it today? Or have you always just laughed it off? Because, as you say, there are two ways to tell the story.
A couple of years ago, somebody said, I heard some lady say, and it's always stuck with me, I think it was a comedian. I wish I knew who said it. Maybe someone will let you know. She said, sport seems to just have been made up so men can have emotions. And I can't really look at sport in the same way since hearing that. Yeah. I can't see a bunch of men or four. What would the four of us sit in a room here now and kind of go, hey, like, it's a different thing if you were to sit down and go, you want to talk about your alcohol addiction?
Yeah.
Okay, it was pretty tough. Reached the bottom, blah, blah, blah. I got help. I'm okay, Like, that's a whole different thing. We can go with sport. Wow, we all, these guys holding on to each other. We're on the bus. We're all of this. It covers up a lot. It inspires. It does so much.
But it's mixed together, as you say.
Yeah.
You look back at what happened that day in 1994. Alcohol is obviously a big part of it.
Oh, it is the part. It is the story for me.
It
is for me. It is for me.
In terms of the control that you can now, I'm putting words in your mouth here, but is it about you looking back at that now and seeing your actions, how your life at that point was controlled by alcohol?
Well, I don't think anyone...
Put it in your own words. I don't want to put words
in
your mouth.
I think that I can see the... I didn't know that alcohol was the problem. So if I don't know that alcohol is a problem, I have to look at my own shortcomings and go, wow, I'm an utterly flawed person. You take on then sense of shame. You take on the sense that I have let Ireland down. I mean, it's a preposterous thing. Mm-hmm. And by the way, my father was just repeating something that was said. It's not him making the judgment. Let's be clear. Yeah. But that is like going, no, no, no. You don't put that on somebody that then you kind of wear a label, you know, in whatever way. So I would have to go, no, listen, who I am is, you know, a multitude of things. So anyway, at the time, I didn't know that alcohol was a problem. I knew I'd gotten drunk and that was a stupid thing to do, right? But if you don't know that, if you're not aware that you're out of control with alcohol, that the alcohol is making you do utterly stupid things when you don't want to do them, you know, I would have, what I would have loved is to see the tricolours all over, to see hear the national anthem, to witness the goal, to come home and go, wow, this is just incredible. And work out why it was incredible, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then sit with like, why is that incredible? It's just a football game. Like, what is it? What were we all looking for at the time? What was the yearning in Irish people at that time?
You stopped drinking 24 years ago, is that what you said. Did everything change and change for the better quite quickly after you stopped drinking?
Overnight.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
I didn't get drunk again.
Simple question.
I mean, I spent a long time trying to figure out what drink got me drunk. Is it the fourth one or is it the fifth one? Like, there was a little area that I would be really good at. Like, is it like trying to find out if you were playing pool? There's one sweet spot at playing pool and darts where I was unbeatable. But I could never really figure out what point it was that I got to that moment where I was okay. And so I didn't realize this. I was trying to figure out what particular drink or got me drunk. And if I couldn't, that's what I wanted to figure out. And then I discovered that it was the first drink got me drunk.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so.
Did it help you become a better actor? Because we're looking at your career and in the four or five years that followed, you were nominated for 3 Tony Awards. You won one of them. And obviously, you were doing very well before that, but did it help matters that you stopped drinking, do you think, in terms of your career?
I mean, help my career, it helped my life. Mm. It's not like, there's no like, oh, okay, great, this helps your career. Like, if you're a drunk or an addict in any way, it doesn't matter about your career or your life. You're not going to really take them in or be present for them if you're an addict in any of the addictions. Yeah. You know, you're just not present, and that's a problem.
Well, you're listening to the BAFTA and Tony Award-winning actor Brian F. O'Byrne on Second Captain Saturday today. If you want to hear one of Ireland's most respected actors paying tribute to one of Meath's best-loved GAA legends, you're in for a treat after the break.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.
We've got Brian F. O'Byrne in studio today. If you haven't already seen Brian starring in the Oscar-winning movie Conclave, we highly recommend you watch it. Brian plays a priest, Monsignor Raymond O'Malley, right-hand man to the Dean, played by Ralph Fiennes, who's...
Kilkenny man.
Is he?
Hold on.
Yeah.
How far back? Is it Tony Cascarino or...
No. They lived in Kilkenny.
Wow.
The Fiennes lived in Kilkenny for quite a while.
Did they?
Yeah, he went to secondary school.
Yeah. Ralph Fiennes went to secondary school.
Could have been a hurler, I presume.
Yeah, do you go to Kieran's?
Hang on a second. Ralph Fiennes, if you're listening, we're just going to keep paying a four each
exactly,
week.
Yeah, yeah. This is a much better way to book guests. If you mention one person, we have to book that person. Yeah.
So Kilkenny's Ralph Fiennes. He is overseeing a conclave in the movie.
And Joe, I worked with his brother Joe on the TV series as well. Joe's a nice guy.
So obviously if you're on stage on a given night, you've got to get a pretty good sense of how the show is going. You know how you've done. You know if somebody else might be having an off night. You see how you feel how the crowd is reacting. When you're in a movie and a lot of your scenes are maybe with one other actor in particular, do you get any sense of the overall, of what's going on and that actually we're making something great here?
Short answer, no. I mean, you know, I was a huge fan of it. Berger, you know, he had done All Quiet on the Western Front, which I thought was just extraordinary. So when this came up, it was great. Ralph is obviously like amazing. And we were in Rome. So it's just, you know, I think film acting, and certainly, you know, I had a smaller part in it. It's a director's and editor's medium. It's not to, well, yeah, t- to downplay actors. It doesn't, you know, we don't make the end thing. So it's kind of like you're just given raw material and they'll go ahead and make the movie. And so while you're doing it, it's like going, I don't know whether this is, you think this will be in it? Or, you know, what, you don't know. Yeah. You kind of feel that some things are good or bad or not working. And there's a whole storyline that, like, that I was like, oh, so you watch and then you go, oh, they took out that. That was my favorite scene. It's gone.
Right. Yeah. So there's stuff you think has gone really well. It's just,
storyline
work in the movie. So.
Yeah. It doesn't work. It's just, and you can kind of go, oh, yeah, I see what they did there. I understand why they just need to go through this. So there was stuff taken out that I was like, ah, that's too bad. But it's like, I was in Rome. Like, you know, you get paid to be in Rome.
No, it's a decent job, all right. Yeah. You won an IFTA for Best Supporting Actor. We loved your acceptance speech. You can play a bit of it now.
There's lots of people here I want to talk to tonight. I'm big fans of a lot of you. Not all, but not a lot. But I've nothing to say. I'm here on my own, so if anyone wants to come talk to me at any time, please do. Thank you.
Just listen to that. You got to get the sense that do you feel like a bit of an outsider in the Irish movie scene, having lived abroad for so long?
I think I feel an outsider in a lot of life, in most of my life.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't think I enter into conversations about how I'm seeing the world with people in the same way. So I see things around me that I want to go, look at that. Like, well, first of all, I mean, until I read Beckett a bit, I was like going, okay, right, this is, oh God. Sorry, I'm not comparing myself to Beckett. Let me just say that. And it's more, I see, I'm constantly amazed at the absurdity of us humans. And I don't really, everyone's trying to go around and be very serious, including myself in lots of ways. And I just going to go, oh, let's look at the kind of, it's all nuts.
So what, you fear the reaction of other people if you bring them into conversation?
No, but there is a safe place to do all of that. And that seems to be in a creative world where you can just kind of go in there and you have a distance in some way, even if you're using yourself. So you can then have the wildest conversations with anyone about anything through the vehicle of any of the arts.
Yeah.
In any way. So that was the first one when I kind of discovered that. I was like, oh, okay, this is a space where you go in and literally play and you can just be as mad as you want and be the different characters. You can kind of examine the world through playing different people and bring your own little lunacies into that as well.
When do you think you made that discovery?
I think it's just as soon as I went in across the street over to Trinity, to drama school. I was like, oh, I didn't grow up around art, or I didn't go to the theatre. I saw maybe three movies before I was 18 in the cinema, and there was no cinema around in Cavan and stuff like that. The only thing there was, actually, back to the sport in a way, is like Ga, and this is the other thing about Ga, it's so bizarre. It has this whole cultural wing, which is like score, these competitions and score. And so I did like kind of like set dancing. I have an All-Ireland in set dancing.
You're joking me. No. Shake my hand. I'm also an All-Ireland winner. Not in set dancing, but in the Throne of Gaeshlin, scoring an All-Ireland.
Oh, fair play. No. You're made for this. Fair play to you. You're the smart fella as well.
I need to step aside.
We can sit down. Anyway, and by the way, okay, that's pretty impressive. But I won it in 84, which is centenary year.
I actually can't compete with that. That is fair.
And that's by the way, the fact that you knew that straight away is a very good sign that you're a scorer.
It never leaves you. It'll be the last thing to go.
He knows his stuff, Brian. He knows his stuff. All right, we'll consider that for your sporting life ranking. That's the reason you're here, of course. So before Murph does his thing, we do need to get this sporting highlight from your own life. This one, I believe, involves a Meath Gaelic football great. And even though you talked yourself down earlier on, you had some game yourself. I've heard rumours of trials for the Cavan County under-16s. I mean, that sounds pretty impressive to me.
It would be impressive if you used the used an S on the end of trials. It was a trial and one game against Louth. a second half sub and I scored a point.
Well, here, we'll
come
take
on
that.
Now. That is, yeah. Yeah. So, I'm already jealous.
And I have a couple of under 14 championships in Cavan. But here we go. I played on, I went to school in Kells. I'm on the border. Muller's on the border. And I went to school in Kells, just over the road into Kells. Into enemy territory at the time, or certainly they let us know that it was enemy territory. And we played, at the time it was like when you played school football, where the jerseys were kept wet from the last game in the bag and just taken out the following week for the game, and you just like kind of pulled them apart and they smelled. And so we played a game. And but on the team, I was playing midfield just only because I was tall. There was no other reason at all at this particular time. I guess it was at the end, playing the seniors or getting up to the leaving cert. And anyway, I played. But in the team, playing midfield beside me was a chap who was a year younger called PJ Gillick, who was just incredible.
I mean, to the two people listening who don't remember PJ Gillick.
I mean, yeah.
He played in five All-Ireland finals in 4 years, I would say. 87, 88, the replay, 1990, 1991. Wow. So, I mean, yeah. So we're talking about one of the key cornerstones of the Meath team of the late 80s and early 90s. The most fearsome,
or one of them in GA history.
Yeah, he could not be a nicer guy. Oh, my God. I mean, as a kid, you know, as I know him as a kid, I don't, you know, I'm sure he has not changed one bit. And he had this, like, incredible loping style on him, and he just a monument of a man. And as a young fella, he was obviously a great footballer.
Yeah.
So cut to, I, you know, go off and fall around the world for a while, and I watch PJ and that Meath team, like just those classic encounters against the Dubs as well, Leinster finals and stuff. It was just like incredible to see PJ there. So many, many, many years later, I meet him, and Muller has a little fair, might be coming up soon in September. They have a fair every year, and surrounding people come in, and I was at home one time during this fair, and up walks PJ with his wife, who was his girlfriend. You know the way county players used to have the most beautiful girlfriend, like as a young man, and they married their school. I think that's what happened to PJ, and they came walking up, and I went, oh my God, PJ. I hadn't seen him in, I don't know, 30 years or something. I was like, my God, I can't believe, you know, the success you've had, and like incredible to watch you over the years, you know, despite being a Meath man.
Yeah.
But like, just incredible. He's such an incredible. And he kind of nodded and said, yeah, yeah. And he went, remember the goal you scored? I went, what? And he went, the goal you scored against Trim. I was like, oh, yeah. And that was a day that, you know, we got a Wednesday off and all piled into a high ace van and went off and pulled on smelly jerseys. And we were losing, as we were wont to do, against a Trim team. But and we were losing with maybe a minute to go or less. We were losing by 2 points. And there was a free kick given just outside the 14. All the Trim players ran into the goals, packed the goals. PJ was obviously going to take the free, and I was standing to the side with zero ability, just standing to the side, just waiting to watch PJ
work his magic,
just do something. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was obviously impossible to score with these many, many things. And he took a quick and hit it to me, which is, I still feel the terror of it, of it landing on me. And I just kind of closed my eyes.
Yeah.
And kicked it as hard as I could, not looking at the target. And it somehow went into the net, and
yes,
we won. And PJ, 30 years later, when I was talking about his incredible achievements, and I went, you remember that? I was like, which? And he went, against Trim. And he was animated when he said it. And it was more like going, how could you possibly be thinking about this moment that was almost embarrassing for me, because I knew that I didn't know what I was doing. And I looked and I was like, oh yeah, but it was only against like Trim. And he went, we had never beaten them. And I suddenly went, wow.
But it's probably the same for you with acting, is it? If somebody brings up something, you might care as deeply about something that 30 people saw when you were 14.
Yeah.
Compared to, conclave or whatever.
No, I think that's a very astute, and I do think it's the same. I think sport and even something like acting is exactly the same. I think what people forget is the feeling that I had stepping on a stage in Score, getting ready to go on Score in some tiny little hall to do something. That complete adrenaline, that feeling is exactly the same as an opening night feeling.
Is it? Yeah, it doesn't change.
It's exactly the same.
Right.
And so when I see my kids or any kids playing, getting ready for football, one of my kids plays both rugby and Ga, and when I see them get ready for a county game where there's nobody around and the excitement in these kids, I go, that's, if you were to go on and be PJ, like he seemed to go, that was a moment. Now, I'm not comparing them, obviously. But what I'm saying is the feelings that we get, whether through the arts or in sport and all that, we think that the feeling is going to drastically change. But actually, it doesn't.
He's also probably a sports person at that level, is used to talking about their All-Ireland finals or whatever it is.
Probably.
They're getting talked about that every day of the week. They don't often get to talk about the time that the time they assisted the great Breen F. O'Byrne. They passed the responsibility on to Breen to bury.
Well, he couldn't take the pressure.
It's quite clear what happened there.
He crumbled.
He knew he had to hand it over to a cabin man. Finally, we beat them.
All right, Breen, I know it's gonna hurt to knock Joseph O'Connor off top spot after he wrote so sympathetically about your escapades at USA 94, but I feel like that's the way this is headed after that last story. Murph, the time has come. A reminder that Joseph leads the 2025 field on 78 points. Spider Stacey lags behind on 74. Could you please now rank this sporting life of Breen F. O'Byrne?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have, then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Breen, it's been a true pleasure talking to you this afternoon, but I can hide from my duties no longer. It's time for me to assess your sporting abilities, pick a sports person that I feel most closely resembles you and your sporting achievements, and then, having considered your all-time sporting highlight, give you points out of 100 to see if you will be crowned our greatest non-sportsperson of 2025. Even leaving aside your USA 94 escapades, you have proven yourself to be a sportsman of the most unimpeachable credentials. You could hang with PJ Gaelic on a Gaelic football field, and if he thought you had the stuff, then I don't think much more needs to be said, quite frankly. Cavan men have always done well in New York, of course, whether that's to do with their work ethic or the New York business scene and its laissez-faire attitude to their tax affairs. It's always been a rich and thriving relationship. For Breen F. O'Byrne on Broadway, read Mick Higgins in Gaelic football, the hero of the Polo Grounds, who was born in New York and returned to the Big Apple to win that All-Ireland for his beloved Cavan 20 years later in 1947. Now, Mick Higgins did a lot of things, but did he ever kick wet 50s into a Gael alongside PJ Gaelic? I don't think so, Owen. And you're a Score All-Ireland winner.
That's incredible.
It's like a lot of points. Handshake.
It is. That is basically,
might be an unfair advantage against the others.
I truly believe that to be the case. Throw in your work on Million Dollar Baby, one of the great sports movies of the 21st century.
Oh, yeah.
And this becomes an increasingly and intimidatingly strong portfolio. It's been an enriching PJ Gaelic heavy conversation today. And I see no reason not to give you 83 points for a nearly possibly unassailable lead
score
this season. Breen F. O'Byrne, this has been your sporting life.
Wow, I'm honoured.
You're in pole position, Breen. That is a big score. A round of applause, please. You've been absolutely brilliant. Breen F. O'Byrne, everybody. That's Jeff Buckley, who famously played at the New York venue mentioned and frequented by Breen F. O'Byrne, Shinné, in the East Village. That was Last Goodbye. And speaking of last goodbyes, here's Big Jack on the USA 94 pitch invasion incident, speaking after the match. The lads got a bit carried away, but the police should remember that these are football fans and they should realise that they weren't running onto the field to assassinate people. The fans were being polite. They weren't resisting. And I think the police were being too rough with them. So I asked if they could go a little easy on the lads.
Jack's instincts on these things, on, they were usually spot on. I mean, is it any wonder we fell in love with the man? But, I mean, he happened to be absolutely correct in this particular...
According to the Irish Examiner, Charlton even talked to one of the supporters as they left the field. I just wished him luck, said the Irish boss.
They weren't going to get lucky for the next half hour, 45 minutes after
no,
that.
But that luck has gone on to see Breen become one of Ireland's best actors and push him towards the greatest non-sportsperson title. We have a new leader, Breen F. O'Byrne, deservedly so for that PJ Gillick story alone. And our thanks to Breen for coming on and speaking so openly about that incident at USA 94 and the impact it had on his life. Really fascinating stuff there. So if you want to hear more Second Captains during the week, you can listen to Murph and I along with the rest of our team Monday to Friday wherever you get your podcasts or through secondcaptains.com. We'll see you back here at 1 o'clock next Saturday. This is a Second Captains production for RTE. Killian Down produces the show. Mark Horgan is the series producer for Second Captains. Our thanks to Janny Lanagan in RTE. Thank you, Murph.
Thank you very much, John.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll speak to you next week. Take care.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.